Let me leave a little space now. Maybe you have some questions or comments.
I think I understand everything you're saying, except when you were speaking about multiple lifetimes. I know for a lot of people that's a tough one to sort of get a handle on, and it's a tough one for me to get a handle on. I mean, I don't remember past lifetimes. I've never met anyone who does. Why should I accept that viewpoint? How did you come to accept it?
Okay, so how did I come to accept multiple lifetimes, and why should you? You know, if you've never met anybody, and you don't know anybody who remembers their previous life. Okay, the fact that we don't remember something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Okay, because you may have had the experience of not remembering where you put your car keys 10 minutes before. Okay, or anybody remember what they ate for breakfast a year ago Tuesday? Okay, do you remember what problem you had 1 year ago on, what is it, July, whatever date we are? Do you remember what your problem was 1 year ago? Okay, there's a lot of things that we've experienced that we can't remember. So the fact that we can't remember it doesn't mean much, okay, except that we have lousy memories. The way I came to have some kind of confidence in multiple lifetimes, because I wasn't brought up with that notion either. You know, I was brought up with there's this one lifetime and after you die, it's over. You know, I wasn't even brought up with heaven and hell. You know, it was like you die, that's it. The way I came to understand it was by thinking about, you know, we have a body and we have a mind. Okay? When they're together, we call that being alive. But the body has its own chain of causes that produced it, and so does our mind, our consciousness. Okay, the body is molecular in nature, so you know you can trace it back to the sperm and egg of your parents, and then you know your genes of your grandparents, and you know all that kind of stuff. You trace the continuity of our body forward, and you know someday it's going to be a corpse, and then it gets recycled, and the worms eat it, and you know it comes out as flowers or something else, right? Okay, I mean, that's this body, that's what's going to happen to it. So the body has a physical continuity, going back in time, going forward in time. Our consciousness is not physical in nature. Okay, it's not made of atoms and molecules. We can't measure it with scientific instruments. And yet it's something that exists. It's the nature of what we call clarity and awareness. Okay, so it's clarity in the fact that it is formless, non-atomic. It's clarity in the fact that our consciousness or mind reflects objects. And it's aware in that we can engage with objects. You know, there's consciousness. I mean, how many of you have seen a dead body? Okay? Something's not there, right? Yeah, there's a difference between that person when they were alive and when they were dead. That difference is consciousness. The body is still there. Yeah, atoms and molecules are still there. But the consciousness is gone. That thing that experienced, that experiential part of them. Okay? But the body still looks exactly, you know, well, not exactly the same. Sometimes it looks better after they come out of the body. Okay. My girlfriend's mom, you know, when I was in college, her mom died, and I went to the funeral, and people were saying, oh, she looks so much better now than she did all those years she had cancer. I couldn't believe it. You know. Anyway, and so, but our mind has a continuity, you know. We can trace it back. Today's mind came from yesterday's mind. Trace the continuity of our mind back to the time of conception. Where did the first moment of consciousness come from? From a previous moment of consciousness of being in a previous life. Okay. When we die, we get to the time of death. The death is simply the body and mind going their own ways. Body becomes a corpse. Mind keeps going. You know, it goes on, it goes into a future life. It has a continuity from this life to the next in the same way that it has a continuity from one day to the next and one moment to the next. Okay? So that's some of the thought processes that I, you know, went through. And then also, I think just looking at the diversity of human experience around me was something that really helped me to believe in previous lives, because I came to understand that we don't come into this life as a blank slate. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of you, parents, raise your hands. Yeah. Okay. Your kids, did they come in with a personality or without a personality? They came in with a personality, didn't they? One day old, they have a personality. They aren't blank slates, you know? So there's tendencies, there's habits, there's things that were set in motion in the past that, you know, habitual tendencies that get acted out this lifetime that you can either encourage in the case of good tendencies in your kids or discourage in the case of unproductive ones. Okay? But this kind of way of thinking gave me a feel that, yeah, you know, there could be previous and future lifetimes. Hmm? Yeah?
The context in which you utilized back to we're responsible for our actions, and perhaps we're creating some things that come back to us in our environment. It's really pragmatic, it seems to me, and useful in working with people and ourselves. But also strikes me, I just want to get your opinion, isn't there kind of a narcissistic view that the whole world exists for my enlightenment, to teach me something constantly, and you know, the fact that I could be gone tomorrow and the world would go on, makes more towards our insignificance than seeming like a narcissistic view.
Okay. So, so you said that in one way all this talk about taking responsibility for our experience seems quite pragmatic, but it seems a bit narcissistic because we're always talking about us, you know, changing ourselves and changing our experience, and yet, you know, we could be gone tonight or tomorrow and the world goes on very well without us. That's very true, you know. And I think that I don't see it as narcissistic, and in fact, the fact that the world goes on very well without us, I see as a way of helping us let go of our negative emotions. Okay? In the sense that, let's say somebody did something, I'm really, really angry. I look around, there's 5 billion people on the planet. How many other people are as incensed and upset about this as I am? You know? Not many. In fact, sometimes you can't even find one more person who's as burnt up as you are about it. And then you begin to realize, oh, you know, I've been spinning around my own selfish concerns about how I think the world should be and how I think people should be, you know? And this isn't at all the viewpoint of the rest of the world. So let's just drop, you know, this anger. Let's drop this attachment or this jealousy, because it really is very insignificant. Does that answer your question okay?
It does. It's just another part of this thinking that also kind of assumes, with us being responsible for that out there, that there's no other parties out there being irresponsible. You know,
oh,
the Chinese
oh,
guy,
I see.
All the Tibetans, okay. You know, could say, you can go around thinking, one, well, these seeds were sown in the past. On the other, it's an injustice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, I get what you're getting at now. You're saying if we're constantly saying, my mind's creating my happiness and experience, happiness and suffering, that could be as a way of saying, well, there's nobody else who's responsible for anything happening in the world. Yeah, and that's not correct. I mean, clearly everybody's responsible for their own actions. I'm responsible for my experience of their actions. Okay, if we use the example, let's say, of the actions of the Beijing government against the Tibetan people, yeah? Okay, the people in the Beijing government are responsible for their own actions. I have a choice as to how I respond to that. I could be angry, I could become a terrorist, you know, in response to that, or I could have compassion for people who are, you know, confused in what they're doing and creating negative karma. And I can still speak out against injustice. Okay? So our changing our own mind is changing our reaction. But other people are still responsible for their own actions because they're the ones who generated their the motivations that led to those actions. Okay?
So kind of along that same line, if you see someone doing harm to someone else, so obviously the person that the harm is towards is being harmed, but also the person doing the harm is being
right.
harmed. So like even in the Bodhisattva Vows, it says you should stop that harmful behavior if possible. So I'm just wondering if there's any way to stop someone from doing harm without creating negative karma on your own.
Okay, so how to stop somebody from doing harm without creating negative karma ourselves. You know, one of the things people seem to feel is that anger is the only thing that's going to get us to intervene when somebody else is harming another person. Yeah, that's not true. I mean, why do we have to have anger to stop harm? What about compassion for both parties involved? Okay, so if you can have compassion, knowing this one's experience, this one's the perpetrator of harm in this very moment, but at the same time they're putting these harmful seeds in their own mind. This one's the experiencer of harm at this very moment, and I can have compassion for both of them. Because they're both caught in this web of suffering and confusion, aren't they? Yeah. And so then you can still intervene to try and stop the suffering or minimize it. But you do it for the welfare and benefit of both parties, not just, you know, for one, loving one party and hating the other.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I had two questions for you. One of them was, you know, he was talking about rebirth and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So once you reach, like, nirvana, become, you know, an enlightened being, and your body passes away, what happens to that, like, entity? Are there new entities reborn, or is it the same energy that keeps on again?
Okay, so her question is, at the time one attains nirvana and no longer has to take the body, you know, a body like this, then what happens to consciousness? Yeah. That depends upon the way the person has practiced on the path. Some people, their aspiration has been just to abide in a state of meditative equipoise, meditative peace on the nature of reality, and so that's what they do. Other people, during the whole time they were training, were saying, I want to attain nirvana so that I can work more for the benefit of others. And then those people, out of compassion, will deliberately take rebirths or emanate bodies in this world in order to be of service and benefit to the rest of us.
My second question, I was thinking about something you said last week and about attachment and how there's a lot of chanting, things are changing, people are changing. And I was wondering, in regards to like marriage or a romantic relationship, if you love everyone and everything's always changing and attachment is bad, how can you differentiate that relationship from others?
Okay, so this is one of these nice, simple questions. You know, if you're trying to cultivate a type of love that cares for everybody equally, and at the same time attachment to an individual, you said is bad. I wouldn't phrase it in that way. I would say attachment to people creates suffering. Okay, then what do you do with the whole institution of marriage? Okay, everybody's got to make their own decision about this, okay, so I'm not giving advice for universal consumption, so to speak. And I want to start by saying, we're not saying attachment's bad, okay, let's not put moral judgments on it, you know, like I'm bad because I'm attached. It's when I have attachment in my mind, I create suffering for myself and others. Okay, let's see it like that, you know. When I have attachment, when my mind is biased, when I'm needy and greedy and clingy, I create suffering for myself and other people. Yeah? when I can open my heart to have a more equal view of others. Like we were talking last week, seeing that everybody wants happiness equally, everybody wants to be free of suffering equally, you know, everybody is doing some job in society through which we derive benefit, and so everybody's been kind to us in one way or another. Okay? So when we train our mind to see that, then we don't have so much this clinging, you know, to one person and aversion to other people and kind of apathy towards everybody else. And we start being a little bit more even in terms of our emotions. Yeah. Now, still, within our daily life, there are people that we know better than other people and people we associate and, you know, we see more often than other people. So we act differently towards them. Yeah. And so you act differently to somebody you know well than to somebody that you don't know well. And you act differently to a child than you do to an adult. So in our relationships with other people in society, we still act differently. Yeah. So in terms of a marriage relationship, what I think happens here is some people may decide not to get married or not to get involved in a romantic relationship. You know, that was my personal decision in my life. Other people may decide, no, they want to have that in their life, but then what they make as the centerpiece of their relationship is not their own, you know, personal gratification, yeah, but helping each other grow. Okay, so if people become very good friends, and friendship is the basis of the relationship, and they really want to help each other grow, to become, you know, to lessen, you know, you want to help yourself and the other person have less attachment, less anger, less jealousy, more love and compassion, more of an open heart towards everybody else. And so you make that as a goal of your relationship instead of, I just want to get pleasure from this person and I just want my needs to be met. Okay. So you have a, you restructure your relationship in another way. Okay. Yeah.
What would be the Buddhist perspective on something like clinical depression? Is it karma? Is it something that can be overcome?
Okay.
How does one work with something like that?
Okay, so the Buddhist perspective on clinical depression. This is my opinion. I haven't seen anything written in this, you know, there's no sutra of clinical depression, okay? So what you're getting is, you know, my interpretation. I think that karma is involved, okay? On one hand, karma is involved, but on the other hand, how we are thinking now is also involved, okay? Because we can view things from a very negative viewpoint and make ourselves depressed. And we can view our life and only see what isn't going right and make ourselves depressed, or we can view our life and see everything that we have that's wonderful and be quite happy about it. So depending, a lot of it depends on what we pay attention to, you know? And I think what very often happens in the case of depression is that people get in a habit of looking at the things they don't like about themselves or the things that they don't feel good about in their life, and they focus exclusively on that so that that begins to appear as an external reality and as an internal reality. So I think one element is to begin to look at life from a different perspective and see the goodness that's there. There could definitely be, you know, a chemical constituent to clinical depression. Buddhism has nothing against people using medication if they need that. However, I would always suggest, if medication is needed, that also a change of mental state through, you know, working with our own mind, either through therapy or meditation or however you want to do it, is also required, that you can't just rely on the meds to pull you out, because you have to learn how to look at life and look at yourself in a different way. Okay? Does that satisfy? I can't see your face, so I can't see if you're going like this or like this.
No, that's necessarily what I wanted to hear.
what did you want to hear?
Well, I've suffered from clinical depression for years. I've tried changing my perspective, my output, both using meditation, therapy, prayer, and occasion. And
maybe you just have to learn to be happy being depressed. Yeah. No, just what I'm saying is stop paying so much attention to it. Yeah? Because sometimes we become, I can speak for myself here, so aware of my own feelings that I put so much attention on my own feelings, you know, and get, you know, it becomes very easy to be involved with, you know, I feel crummy, I feel crummy, I feel crummy, and I take out my prayer beads and I do a whole 108 I feel crummies, you know, and then I continue on, you know, all day long with my mantra of I feel crummy. And, you know, at some point I have to push the stop button on that and say there's no sense to this. Yeah? And that, okay, I feel crummy, so be it. But I'm still alive and there's still a lot going on and I'm going to do something. Yeah? So it's I realized one day when I was feeling crummy how much I react against the painful mental feeling, you know, like you feel when you feel depressed or when you feel crummy. There's a real dislike of that feeling, you know. And then in reaction to that feeling, saying, I don't like it, I don't like it, I don't want to feel crummy, I don't want to feel crummy, I should feel better, you know. And then the mind can get really quite tormented by that. Whereas if I just say, okay, I feel crummy, and we have a meditation in Buddhism called the taking and giving meditation, where we imagine taking on the suffering of others and using it to destroy our own self-centeredness, and then radiating out love and compassion, and imagine giving our body and possessions and positive potential to everybody else, and imagining them receiving it and being happy. And so when I feel crummy, I do this meditation. I say, okay, I feel crummy. May my crumminess suffice for all the depression and suffering of all other living beings. You know, may that come on top of my head right now, you know. And in this meditation, we imagine taking on other suffering. And then it becomes like a lightning bolt that shocks right at our own heart, where the own center of our own self-centeredness and our own depression. And it blows it up. It blows it to smithereens, leaving a clear, empty space. And then you radiate, you know, your own goodness and love and compassion towards others, and imagine giving them, you know, what you have and them being happy. And I find if I do that meditation when I feel depressed, you know, I stop focusing on what's going on with me, and my mind opens, and it's like, wow, you know, I see the world in an entirely different way. Okay, so that's what I meant about, you know, learning to be happy when you're depressed, in the sense of, you know, yeah, okay, I feel crummy, big deal. Yeah, let's go on, and let's do something useful in life.
Thank you.
Okay? This will be the last question. Uh-huh.
In Indian traditions, Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, and others, I'm sure, there's a belief that giving up one's selfish motivations and working for other people, for others, service to others is the highest good.
Mm-hmm.
And what about oneself is also one of many beings? So should not working for one's own happiness also be as good as working for other people's happiness? Or does one put oneself in a lower position than everybody else?
Okay. Okay, this is a good question. So he's saying that in many Eastern religions, there's the feeling that being of service to others and caring about the welfare of others is the highest good. So does this mean that we should ignore ourselves, because aren't we one of many? Okay. This is part of the thing that I meant at the beginning of the talk when I said that we're confused about what happiness is. Because sometimes we think that if I get the external thing or the external circumstance that's going to make me happy, that's all I need to do. Yeah. But we live in a world where we're completely interdependent with others. And if we work only for our own happiness and don't care beans about others, we're going to live in a society with a lot of other unhappy people. And are we going to be happy living, being surrounded by other people who are unhappy? No. We're going to be miserable. So His Holiness Dalai Lama says that if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. Okay? Because if you take care of others, you know, it leads to one's own happiness. Okay? So we are worthwhile and we deserve to be happy. But if we are selfishly looking out for our own benefit, we actually wind up creating our own unhappiness. But if we take care of others, we wind up creating our own happiness. In many ways, because first of all, okay, karmically, if we take care of others, we're creating positive karma that will ripen in us living in happy situations. Second, if we act in kind ways and take care of others, the people around us are happy. Then we live in a more peaceful society. There's less violence. There's more goodwill. There's more friendliness. There's less robbery. You know, we're happy ourselves living surrounded by people like that. Third, if we're kind to other people, we feel good about ourselves. Yeah? I mean, that's the root of a lot of our self-respect, being able to, you know, to show kindness. Because, you know, look at it this way. When you're selfish and you're looking out for your own benefit, do you feel good about yourself even if you get what you want? We feel crummy about ourselves, okay? But if we really have an open heart and we're taking care of other people and we really genuinely care about others, that is how we derive a lot of our own self-respect, okay? And we feel a lot better when we respect ourselves than when we're greedy and selfish. Okay? Yeah? So it doesn't mean that we negate ourselves and don't take care of ourselves. Okay? But it means that we really think about happiness from a very different view and what really is going to create happiness in this situation. Because lots of times, you know, we can see in relationships, we push and push and push and get our way and make, you know, our mother, father, spouse, husband, wife, whoever it is, you know, children, partner at work, do what we want. And we think, oh, good, I got my way, I'm going to do what we want. But here we are living with somebody else who's unhappy. Is that going to be fun? No way. Okay? So that's why we have to, you know, look out for other people's welfare, because we are interrelated and interdependent. Okay, so keep quietly for a couple of minutes. Yeah? And just reflect on what you heard. Quiet in terms of your own life.